Maddie is brought to you by 9.com.au. To enjoy some of our other great shows, such as NRL podcast Six Tackles with Gus, or our deep dive into the royal family, the Windsors, head to 9.com.au/podcasts or search for us wherever you listen.
In the following podcast from 9.com.au, we are not suggesting Kate and Jerry McCann were responsible for what happened to Maddie or are lying. Her case is simply a mystery, but they were considered suspects by the Portuguese police, and we examine why that was and why the questions about what happened to Maddie haven't gone away.
We're just hearing that a search is underway for a three-year-old British girl who's gone missing in the Algarve area of Portugal.
Someone's taken her. Madeline's gone.
Words cannot describe the anguish and despair that we are feeling as the parents of our beautiful daughter, Madeline.
Parents of Madeline McCann are now considered formal suspects by the Portuguese police authorities.
We have played no part in the disappearance of our lovely daughter, Madeline.
There are days when you just want to get under the duvet or just want to be in a coma till it's over, just to relieve the pain and get some peace, but you can't.
Before we get started on this week's episode, a little bit of an update. A couple of episodes back, we uncovered revelations that an expert called Dr. Mark Perlin could finally solve the DNA samples that were ruled inconclusive in 2007. Dr. Perlin claimed his technology, True Allele, would finally be able to untangle the DNA samples that could provide answers about what happened to Madeline McCann. About a week ago, Dr. Perlin made a formal offer to Operation Grange to get those samples and assist their investigation. To date, he's had no reply from Operation Grange detectives or DCI Nicola Wall, who heads up that investigation. In the meantime, I've contacted the UK Home Office. They refused to comment and sent me back to Scotland Yard. At that point, I thought I'd contact Theresa May, UK Prime Minister. She was the person who launched Operation Grange when she was the Home Office Minister in 2011. Her office received my request for comment and then referred me back to the Home Office. So, where are we at? There are other avenues to get that DNA data that we're aware of and we are pursuing. So let's get on with Episode 8.
Kathleen was my life. I have whispered her name in my heart a thousand times. She is there. But I can't stop crying.
I knew instantly that my sister had been murdered.
In my opinion, the manner of death in this case is homicide.
With all due respect to Dr. Radish, I've got to say that I think her study was the epitome of junk science.
Are these stains consistent with a fall, or are they consistent with some other action?
He is a person who knows how to create a fictional plot.
I would never have done anything to hurt her.
Michael Peterson was the subject of the popular Netflix true crime series, The Staircase. The Staircase focused on a mysterious crime in 2001 where Michael's wife was found dead, her head split open at the bottom of a staircase in their North Carolina mansion. Peterson's defense lawyer is a guy called David Rudolph. David worked on the Peterson case for 15 long years, fighting for and finally winning Michael's freedom. After The Staircase, David became something of a digital age folk hero. In this next run of audio, you'll hear David Rudolph speak. He's the guy who mentions an expert witness who delivered a misleading report.
It's a case that spanned more than 15 years. Mike Peterson has been in and out of Durham County Court since first being accused of killing his wife, Kathleen, in 2001. He's maintained his innocence, saying his wife fell. He was convicted of murder in 2003, but released in 2011 after that conviction was overturned. A judge determined one of the state's key witnesses lied on the stand about evidence.
I don't think the DA cares about truth anymore. This has become a show.
The back of the head was struck three times.
Dwayne Deaver had a pattern of preparing misleading expert reports.
Scientists are not supposed to take sides.
I first spoke to David Rudolph last year for a story I wrote about The Staircase. In that interview, David told me that when Michael Peterson was initially found guilty, It shook the foundations of his belief in the justice system. So why are we talking about David? Well, David is a longtime crusader for justice. He graduated from the prestigious NYU Law School in 1974. He's been in the game a long time. He's seen a lot of things, unusual things. I wanted to ask David a bit about those inconclusive DNA samples that we've been trying to get into the hands of DNA expert Dr. Mark Perlin. I also thought David would be a great person to explain how the media can influence a trial and the judicial process. That's what the rest of this episode is about, how the British and Portuguese media told the McCann story. As we were talking, David said some interesting things about police corruption and inherent bias, which can exist in some police investigations.
I think certainly there is some corruption in specific police forces and in specific districts and with specific judges. But I think the larger problem is not the kind of corruption that we normally think about, but what might be called and what is called noble cause corruption. And that's the kind of corruption that occurs when the police believe in a particular theory and take steps that are extrajudicial in order to prove their theory because, as we might put it, in their view, the ends justify the means.
I asked David if regular everyday people often struggle to believe corruption can and does exist in law enforcement.
Well, I think they do until you really understand that police officers and investigators and judges are human beings. And we all of us suffer from confirmation bias, where we tend to ignore facts that are inconsistent with our beliefs and emphasize facts that are consistent with our beliefs. We all, to a greater or lesser extent, suffer from tunnel vision in that same way. I don't think there are very many judges and police officers who are, as we might think of it, on the take, who are trying to frame innocent people or being paid in one way or another to engage in misconduct. Rather, I think the much larger problem is with police officers and even judges having a certain arrogance about their ability to determine what actually happened and then falling prey to tunnel vision and confirmation bias.
During our conversation, I broadly explained to David the existence of those inconclusive DNA samples and Scotland Yard's apparent unwillingness to take up Dr. Perlin's offer to test and solve that evidence. I wanted to know what he made of that.
First of all, we have to assume that the DNA technology is reliable. And the further we get into mixed samples and minute quantities, and the more we get into algorithms and formulas to establish DNA matches, the less reliable those results are. So I think you have to take that into account in forming any judgment. But the natural conclusion, I think, is that what's the harm of doing the analysis? And if you don't want to do the analysis, then perhaps what you're afraid of is that you'll be shown to have been wrong in your initial theory. And that's hard for people. You know, it's hard for people to admit they're wrong, and it's hard for people to agree to testing that may show they're wrong. So, you know, what it says to me is that whoever is resisting it is human, and they're somewhat concerned that what they initially thought may not be the case.
Another question I put to David was, how difficult is it for prosecutors to win a case without the body of a victim?
Well, it certainly makes it a lot harder. You know, is it impossible? I don't think it's impossible. Certainly, you can prove a murder circumstantially, and evidence of a body is simply one element of proof. I can't tell you in the abstract how much more difficult it is because it depends on all of the other evidence in the case. It boils down to two things. Number one are the statements of various people. So obviously, if someone has confessed in a reliable way, in a non-coercive way, and then you can have a web of circumstances that consists of motive and opportunity to prove that that someone's been murdered and that a particular person committed the murder. As I said, it makes it much more complicated, but certainly not impossible.
Filming for The Staircase spanned 15 long years, documenting the turbulent journey of Michael Peterson and David Rudolph. It was a high-profile case in the US, so it attracted a lot of media attention. There's one confronting scene in The Staircase, where a court reporter gives a misleading account of what happened in Michael Peterson's murder trial that day. In the clip, David Rudolph is on the couch with his private investigative friend. They're watching the news broadcast from his motel room. David flips out, warning, there's an F-bomb coming.
And there you see Rudolph continuing his attack on the witness who is basically helping the state support the integrity of that crime scene. You have a question for Gene about the crime scene?
I did. I'm still bothered by the fact that there were footprints, I believe, in the kitchen, and they had been cleaned up, the blood had been cleaned up, and I still have not seen an explanation of when they were cleaned and why they were cleaned.
Gene, before we go to break, I want to ask you another question. Are you telling me that bloody footprints were cleaned up before the police arrived?
I think we have to assume at this point. Now, the prosecution is going to say they were cleaned up, but the defense...
Infuriated by the news report, David jumps up from the couch, takes his phone, storms out of the room, and calls producers at the news channel.
Who has said that anyone washed the floor in the kitchen?
I mean, come on. Yeah, I mean, she's saying stuff there that, I mean, it's just... I understand, you know, you'll want to pump the ratings or whatever, but give me a break.
During our conversation, David explained to me about the influence of the media and the importance of controlling the narrative. It's pretty interesting stuff.
I think it's critically important, and the police know that full well. At least in jurisdictions where they can do so, early on in the case, the police put out publicity, prosecutors put out publicity that is certainly designed to A, obtain information, and B, to set the stage for public perception of what's to come next. I think similarly, most criminal defense lawyers in this day and age understand that and take steps to counter that by providing their own narrative in one way or another to the media. But the reality is that, especially in these days of social media, people's opinions about things get formed very early. And once someone has formed an opinion, a confirmation bias kicks in. And it becomes very hard to change that person's opinion, you know, with new facts, because they tend to discount the facts that are inconsistent with their opinion. So I think, you know, pure psychology and social media combine to tell us that getting your narrative out early and in a persuasive way is extremely important in the criminal justice area.
My name is Mark Salnokonoko, and I'm a reporter for 9.com.au, and this is a podcast called Maddie. The Maddie podcast series explores what many believe is the well-known story of Madeleine McCann's disappearance. But this is an investigation of the evidence that could make you question everything you thought you knew about the case. In 2011, an Australian TV reporter put Madeleine McCann's father, Jerry, on the spot with a brutally direct question. Did you kill your daughter? That unsettling question was one that for some people had lingered uncomfortably over the McCanns after Madeleine had mysteriously vanished. In the interview, Kate and Jerry are sitting in what looks to be a hotel room. Jerry is wearing a short-sleeved, blue-and-white checked shirt. He sat very closely to Kate, who is wearing a pink cardigan and floral dress. At the time, Kate McCann was promoting her just-published book, Madeline, a memoir outlining what she said had happened on that fateful family holiday. So here's journalist Rani Sadler asking Jerry McCann the question.
Did you kill your daughter?
No. That's an emphatic no. I mean, the ludicrous thing is what's been purported from Portugal is that Madeline died in the apartment by an accident and we hid her body. Well, when did she have the accident and died? Because the only time she was left unattended was when we were at dinner. So if she died then, how could we have disposed or hidden her body, you know, when there was an immediate search? It's just nonsense. So, and if she died when we were in the apartment or fell and did, why would we cover that up?
6 years later, in 2017, Australian broadcaster Channel 7 aired further footage of that television interview. This time, it showed additional footage of Jerry McCann's answer to the question, did you kill your daughter? If you listen carefully, everything you hear Jerry say, leading up to the point when he eventually says no, that's an emphatic no, well, that part of his answer had been edited and cut out the first time the interview went to air in 2011.
Did you kill your daughter?
No, never. And, you know, there's nothing with any logic that could, you know, you would have to start with why, you know, how, when, who, and there's just simply, you know, the answer to any of these things is there's nothing to suggest anything. So, no, that's an emphatic no.
Same question, one answer, but presented two different ways. Now, people will read into those clips differently, but at the very least, it very simply showed the ability of the media to shape a story. But before we get into that, Mark McLeish is a retired US Marshal who over the last 25 years has studied deceptive language and how people make statements. Mark now trains law enforcement officials and others to detect possible deceptive language. I asked Mark what, if anything, he noted in Jerry's answers to the question, did he kill his daughter?
Of course, the answer was one word, no. You know, that would be a good denial. So the lengthy answer is an indication that he's trying to explain himself. And the question is, why is he doing that? Now, most truthful people won't do that. They'll just answer the question. They may say, no, I did not kill my daughter. But they won't try to elaborate on it because that's the truth. It's out there for you to believe or not. Deceptive people, though, sometimes will spend more time trying to convince you that what I'm telling you is the truth.
At this point, Mark added some pretty important context. He said that what he's just outlined is especially relevant if an alleged crime has just occurred. The timing of someone's statement in relation to an alleged crime is important.
If years have gone by and the person, and at least in the public, has been accused of committing this crime, then years later when they're asked that question, they may feel the need to explain a little bit more because they've been suffering through all this persecution and everybody thinks they did it. And so that now, to them, just saying no is not good enough. I do have to explain it a little bit. And so it's something we have to take into consideration, how much time has gone by, how much public scrutiny have they been through.
Now, I think that probably applies to Jerry McCann. During the investigation, police appeared to have some suspicions that Kate and Jerry could have been involved in Madeline's disappearance. The media at times also leveled accusations about Kate and Jerry. As the Madeline McCann case, with all its intricacies, evolved, the UK and Portuguese media ended up telling two quite different stories about what might have happened to Madeline. This episode looks at why that was and why bad blood still simmers today. In late 2014, a British journalist named Sonia Poulton began making a documentary about the Madeline McCann case. Sonia's written for a variety of UK newspapers. She's also been a regular TV commentator for broadcasters such as ITV and Sky News. Sonia explained to me how media colleagues and contacts in the industry greeted her plans with tepid whispers.
I was told
previous to starting the documentary that this is the one story you don't pursue, Sonia, which sent a flag to my brain that that was the one story I must pursue.
In October 2015, Sonia released a preview trailer for her documentary. The trailer hinted at what parts of the McCann case she would be exploring.
In the last decade, Madeline has become the world's most famous missing person, with her case receiving unprecedented police time and public funds in two countries. Add to this, accusations of police favouritism and leniency towards Madeline's parents, Kate and Jerry McCann, and this story becomes a significant talking point for millions of people.
The trailer for Sonia's documentary was meant to attract interest and potential funding from production houses. Instead, it had an unexpected effect.
Prior, the year leading up to that, I had been on TV and radio over 50 times as a social commentator, all across the board, all across the main news and TV networks, over 50 times. In the year following the release of the teaser trailer, I didn't appear once. I think that figure pretty much speaks for itself. People were very, very scared to be seen to be employing or bringing in the services of a journalist who questioned whether Madeline McCann had been abducted or not. That's all I've ever done. All I've ever done is question the abduction story. I've made no grand theories, never ever done that. All I've ever done is say there are a number of elements, as you know, that simply do not add up and need to be questioned. That's all I've ever done. And for that, I have been ostracized.
But let's track back to the beginning, back to when the spotlight of the world's media began to zero in on that small coastal town of Praia da Luz. From early on, the Portuguese and British journalists in Praia da Luz divided into two camps, where the seeds of rivalry and distrust would grow. Naturally, of course, there was a language barrier. But one thing the UK reporters were certainly not used to was the lack of information from Portuguese police. In the UK, the flow of information from police to the public and media is fairly standard and to be expected. But in Portugal, that's just not the case. Portuguese police are bound by and operate under a judicial secrecy law. This means police do not give out information about ongoing investigations, even missing persons cases. Whereas in the UK, police will deliberately roll out a steady stream of information in missing persons cases. This tactic is a strategic tool for UK police. The wall of silence the UK journalists encountered put them in a tricky spot. In Praia da Luz, you had a huge contingent of hungry British reporters with demanding editors in London. There were front pages and news bulletins to fill. The 24/7 news cycle was becoming entrenched in popular culture. Newspaper circulations and profits spiked whenever a Madeline McCann story appeared on the front page. The Portuguese journalists had sources inside the police willing to talk, and the British did not. The pressure was on. At a certain point of the investigation, in the late summer of 2007, a number of UK papers, particularly the tabloids, began to attack the Portuguese police. The UK red top tabloids began calling Portuguese detectives names like Keystone Cops and Keystone Cretins. The words bungling, inept and drunken were used dozens of times. Perhaps the nadir was an opinion piece that ran in UK tabloid The Mirror, dated October 2007, 1 month after the McCanns were declared arguidos. In a brutal takedown, Mirror journalist Tony Parsons tackled accusations from Portugal's ambassador to Great Britain that the McCann case had seriously damaged relations between the two nations. "Whose fault is that?" Parsons wrote. "It is the fault of the spectacularly stupid, cruel Portuguese police. I've never cared much for the convention of calling cops pigs or filth, but I'm happy to make an exception." The article ended with Parsons telling Portugal's ambassador to "keep your stupid sardine-munching mouth shut." Paulo Reis, a veteran Portuguese journalist who covered the case, including work for UK newspaper The Times, told me just how tense the situation became.
"Was some hostility between the Portuguese police and the British journalists. I can tell you the Portuguese police just hated the British journalists.
Paulo told me the attacks on the Portuguese police investigation, in his opinion, appeared to be coordinated and organized. At first, Paulo said he thought those kind of stories were just a temporary ploy of editors to boost circulation. But then, he said, it seemed to be a consistent trend.
I cannot believe that this was just by accident. Maybe in the beginning, I thought, well, this is probably the beginning of the silly season. There's something here that can be a good story to sell newspapers. That was my first feeling, my first idea. But I don't believe that this was just by accident, because it was so, how can I say, there was no exception in the British media, in the British tabloids. They all follow the same line covering the case. Basically, Portuguese police is absolutely incompetent. They botched the investigation. Gonçalo Amaral is a drunk, absolutely incompetent. How is it possible that all newspapers, all tabloids follow the same line? How is it possible?
So, were the British tabloids right? Was the investigation incompetent? Had it been bungled? Well, in episode 4, I broadly outline the tremendous amount of resources that Portuguese police poured into the mission to find Madeline. It was a huge operation, which also involved British police and UK search specialists.
It was not like every other story, I think. Stuff were organized from the beginning.
Duarte Levy, another Portuguese reporter, explained to me how various Portuguese journalists had good inside access to the police. The flip side of that, according to Duarte, was that it was British reporters who got the best access to the McCanns. Duarte described to me how he remembered the rapid influx of UK journalists to the small town of Praia da Luz less than one day after Maddie went missing.
In 24 hours, there were more than 100 journalists over there, and on the days after that, things were organized like an election campaign. There were press conferences at the precise times. The McCanns, by example, made walks with precise timing. Everything was organized from one side and from another. So since the beginning, it was a world media coverage that was organized, different from all the other cases concerning missing child that I already had covered.
That highly organized approach described by Duarte was orchestrated by a man named Alex Wolfel, an influential expert who specialized in crisis PR. Alex Wolfel worked for communications group Bell Pottinger, at the time one of the world's leading public relations firms. In 2017, Bell Pottinger was shut down in disgrace following a terrible scandal involving accusations that while working for a very wealthy family, the firm had incited racial divide in South Africa. Even before it closed down, critics had labelled Bell Pottinger as experts in reputation laundering. Bell Pottinger's own reputation was one of a vastly skilled PR firm, sometimes willing to go places where others were not. Their client list included President F.W. de Klerk of apartheid-era South Africa, Oscar Pistorius after he was charged with murder, and the family of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. Alex Wolfel had been dispatched to Praia da Luz because Mark Warner Limited, the UK tourism company who owned the Ocean Club Resort, was a client of Bell Pottinger. Although Wolfel was there to act for Mark Warner Limited, in the fortnight after Maddie vanished, he also worked as a de facto media advisor for the McCanns. His expert support and guidance, and how to best handle the enormous and overwhelming demands of the huge media pack, was crucial and beneficial for the McCanns. In 2011, the UK government launched the Leveson Inquiry, which was a public inquiry into the ethics and practices of the British press following a phone hacking scandal involving News of the World reporters. Jerry McCann gave testimony at the inquiry. He recalled driving back to apartment 5A with Kate after they had both given their first police statements to Portuguese detectives on May 4, the day after Madeline vanished.
When we were driving back towards the apartment, it was in the evening, and we could literally see tens, if not hundreds, of journalists outside the apartment and satellite vans, etc., large number of cameras. So there was clearly pressure to produce a story. The reporters who were based in Praia da Luz, first thing they did each day was get the Portuguese press, get it translated, and decide what they were going to write about.
When news of Madeline broke, there was an outpouring of sympathy for the McCanns. And during a conversation I had with British reporter Sonia Poulton, she told me about the mood inside UK newsrooms and the appetite to cover the story, and in particular, the issue of neglect.
There was initially a great deal of sympathy for the McCanns because a lot of people who write for newspapers and work in media in the UK can relate to what the McCanns did. Leaving children on holiday is actually a sort of an acceptable middle-class thing, I since discovered. But there was a lot of people in media, I discovered, who absolutely empathised with Kate and Jerry on a basis of their but for the grace of God go I. When the tide did start to turn, and the newspapers became not just more questioning, but it was actually a very dark period in journalism because a British journalist for a period of time during the summer of 2007 were taking pretty much any, you know, spurious line from Portuguese press and turning it into a headline.
Near the end of June, the tone of the British and Portuguese reporting began to change. Building during July and August and peaking in September, headlines and stories became more accusatory of the McCanns. At its very worst, one of the newspapers in the Express Group, the Daily Star, falsely claimed the McCanns were broke and could have sold Maddie into slavery. The investigation ran on, but aside from scores of mistaken sightings of Maddie around the world, there were few fresh details to report. The press pack needed feeding, and there was a captivated audience with its own voracious appetite. Giving evidence at the Leveson inquiry, Kate and Jerry claimed leaks likely emanating from Portugal's police into the hands of Portuguese journalists were not just repurposed and reported on in the British media, but they were often grossly amplified. Here's some of Kate and Jerry's testimony.
The clear message that was going out nationally, throughout Europe and internationally, was that there was very strong evidence that our daughter was dead and that we were somehow implicated in her disappearance. And we knew that if people believed that, then there couldn't be a meaningful search.
I desperately wanted to shout out, it's not true, it's not true. But when it's your voice against the powerful media, you know, it just doesn't hold weight.
The first really bad thing was an article that was written in a Portuguese paper, which was entitled Pact of Silence. And it was starting to refer that there was some sort of sinister agreement between us and our friends to cover up what had happened.
During the Leveson inquiry, the McCanns and other high-profile individuals, including actor Hugh Grant, author J.K. Rowling, and singer Charlotte Church, all gave testimony in the hope of regulatory reform of the press, particularly around complaints, apologies, and issues of privacy and libel. But some also criticised the McCanns for courting the press after Maddie went missing. The insinuation was that the McCanns had invited a Frankenstein into their world and then wanted it out when they found out it was an uncontrollable and unforgiving monster. From the outset, the Portuguese police did not want the McCanns talking to the media, but the McCanns appeared to disagree. In a 2014 book titled The Establishment and How They Get Away With It, English journalist Owen Jones included a quote from Lord Tim Bell, then chairman of Bell Pottinger. Lord Bell was talking about the ramifications of the Leveson inquiry on the British press. He's quoted as saying,
"I'm not really interested in what the McCanns think, because the McCanns paid me £500,000 in fees to keep them on the front page of every single newspaper for a year which we did.
I contacted Lord Bell about that very interesting comment. Lord Bell told me, and I quote, "I would not comment on anything written by Owen Jones." I then asked him if he would be willing to speak about wider aspects of the McCanns and their relationship with UK media. Lord Bell declined, telling me it was too long ago. In a 2009 appearance on the BBC with no-nonsense news journalist Jeremy Paxman, Jerry McCann refuted the idea that because the McCanns had engaged the media, that it meant he and his family were fair game.
But then you had this entire media circus.
I agree, it was a circus.
Camped out around you. But you collaborated with them when it was convenient to you, didn't you? And you would announce photo calls and then whether or not you'd be speaking that day or whether maybe tomorrow or the day after. I mean, do you think to some degree you reaped a whirlwind?
We reaped a whirlwind? No. I presume you're taking a very much a devil's advocate's position here in what you're doing. We had very clear objectives, what we wanted, and any parents would take the opportunity of trying to get information into the investigation that might help find their daughter, and that's what our clear objectives were.
As far as I can tell, there appears to have been two driving factors that helped rein the press in. Well, at least rein the UK press in, not so much their Portuguese counterparts. One, a number of unprecedented and massive libel payouts were awarded to the McCanns, the Tapas 7 and Robert Murat for defamation and inaccurate reporting. And two, the arrival of a media man named Clarence Mitchell, who would become the McCann family's closest advisor. In early 2008, the McCanns were awarded £550,000 from the Daily Express and its sister newspaper, the Daily Star, which was paid into the official Find Madeline Fund. Both papers were forced to run front-page apologies. The Friends of the McCanns, the Tapas 7, were also awarded around £375,000 in damages from Express newspapers. That six-figure sum was also donated to the fund. Robert Murat too was paid out more than £600,000 in libel suits against 11 British newspapers. Broadcaster B Sky B paid him damages in a separate libel case. What those punishing libel rulings did, almost overnight, was to hugely raise the stakes of any debate in the press about how Madeline might have gone missing. Like anybody in their position, the McCanns have every right to go after media who defame them. And there were some terrible lies written about the McCanns. In March 2008, a Time magazine article seemed to encapsulate the new terrain upon which it was possible, certainly in Britain, to report on the case. The article, which likened the intense media coverage to the death of Princess Diana, stated,
"For a paper to now imply that the couple was somehow guilty of killing Madeline is now a door marked closed. And if you're going to open it, you had better have substantial evidence."
Clarence Mitchell was the head of the Media Monitoring Unit, the MMU. You'll remember the MMU is a UK government media unit linked to 10 Downing Street and the Cabinet Office. An influential media man, Clarence Mitchell had at one time been a senior BBC reporter. Days after Kate and Jerry were declared arguidos, Clarence Mitchell quit his high-profile job as director of the MMU and began working full-time for the McCanns. Journalist Sonia Poulton told me about the impact she believed Clarence Mitchell had had on the media reporting of the McCann case.
Within 24 hours of him becoming the permanent spokesperson for Kate and Jerry McCann in September 2007, his BBC colleagues were already noting that the media coverage had turned around and was not so critical of the McCanns and was actually much more empathetic. And that was down to the work of Clarence Mitchell.
Clarence Mitchell remains the McCanns' trusted spokesperson. I approached Clarence, requesting an interview with Kate and Jerry. On their behalf, he politely declined. Instead, I asked if he wished to field some of my questions. Again, he politely declined. Although the huge libel payouts in Britain might have stifled the UK press, they had less effect on the Portuguese media. Portuguese journalists continued to speculate about the cadaver dogs and the DNA samples taken from the McCanns' hire car. Where the British backed off, the Portuguese kept pushing. There were some tense encounters between Portuguese reporters and the McCanns. In this 2009 interview, Portuguese TV journalist Sandra Felgueiras asked Kate and Jerry about the cadaver dogs that searched and alerted in their apartment and car. Remember, the work of cadaver dogs must be corroborated by additional evidence.
How can you explain the coincidence of the scent of the cadaver felt by British and not Portuguese dogs?
Sandra, maybe you should be asking the judiciary because they've examined all this.
But don't you, so you don't have any explanation for that?
Ask the dogs, Sandra.
Ask the dogs, no, Jerry. Now I think that I feel free to ask you. Don't you feel free to answer me?
I can tell you that we've obviously looked at evidence about cadaver dogs and they're incredibly unreliable.
Unreliable?
Cadaver dogs, yes. That's what the evidence shows. If they're tested scientifically.
But if the McCanns and their lawyers were content to leave most Portuguese media outlets and journalists alone, there was one man they were determined to stop, Gonzalo Amaral. In October 2007, when the lead detective was abruptly dumped from the case, Amaral began to write a book about the investigation. The book would document his 6 months leading the case, and he would outline a theory of what happened to Madeline. 2 days after the Portuguese police investigation was shelved, in July 2008, Amaral released The Truth of the Lie. The launch of the 22-chapter book would trigger a long and bitter legal feud with the McCanns. The McCanns claimed Amaral's book would have a hugely detrimental effect on the search for Maddie. In short, if people thought Maddie was dead, who would search for her? The McCanns began a protracted legal battle to have Amaral's book banned. Initially, they succeeded, and an injunction was placed on the book. And the McCanns successfully sued Amaral for 500,000 euros. After that court victory, Kate McCann spoke to the press, praising the decision and calling Amaral's book an injustice against Madeline.
The court has demonstrated once again that there is no evidence that Madeline has come to any harm. The motives of Mr. Amaral and others who have tried to convince the world that Madeline is dead and who've also tried to implicate us in her disappearance need to be seriously questioned and looked at. As painful and personally damaging as the slanderous claims of Mr. Amaral and his supporters have been to us and our family, our primary focus has always been and always will be to find Madeline.
But in 2016, a court tossed that decision out and ruled the injunction had violated Amaral's freedom of expression. The McCanns challenged the new ruling, but in early 2017, Portugal's highest court, the Supreme Court, rejected the McCanns' bid. It ruled Amaral could exercise his legal right to freedom of expression. It ruled the book was not libelous or abusive. I contacted the publisher of Gonzalo Amaral's book, and while they wouldn't agree to a phone interview, Manuel S. Fonseca of publisher Guerra and Paz did make a statement to me over email. Manuel confirmed the 2008 book had quickly become a number one bestseller in Portugal, selling around 180,000 copies. Though never printed in English, it was sold in Spain, Italy, France, Germany, Belgium, Holland, and Scandinavia. Manuel Fonseca wrote, "I'm a publisher, and it is for me a matter of principle not to ban books. Otherwise, just in logical terms, the possibility that the child died at the apartment, by accident for example, is a scenario that was part of the investigation. You can't forbid people to make logical assumptions. The Supreme Court decision unequivocally says that Gonzalo Amaral's book, contrary to what Gerald and Kate McCann alleged, doesn't affect the couple's right to privacy, or even their legitimate right to image and good name, since the facts exposed in the book were all public and known all over the world. And they were first in the public police report before Amaral wrote his book." I asked Manuel Fonseca if the book would ever be printed in English, and he replied, "Do the English language publishers have the freedom and strength to go ahead? We are open to a clear and brave proposition." In In conclusion, he said the following of Amaral.
There was a machine against him, and that machine did anything it could to cause him harm in his personal and professional life. I salute my author for his strength in defending his professional integrity and his freedom of speech, as they are stated in the Portuguese Constitution.
More than £11 million of UK taxpayer funds has been spent by Scotland Yard in the search for Madeline. Speaking to Sonia Poulton, I can feel the sense of frustration at the lack of an open debate about the Maddie case.
Well, the clear narrative is that Kate and Jerry McCann and their friends had set up a questionable babysitting routine, which meant that they left their small children, McCann's children, three of them had a collective age of seven. A number of small children were apparently left alone evening after evening while the McCanns and their primarily doctor friends dined at the nearby tapas bar in Portugal. And on one of those nights, May the 3rd, 2007, during one of the checks, they discovered that Madeline had gone missing. It stood the test of time in the British media, but it doesn't stand the test of time if you even give it a cursory investigation. I don't believe the official narrative, and as I say, I never have. It is highly questionable. There are many aspects and elements about it that are highly questionable. But for me as a journalist, what is most highly questionable is that you're not allowed to question it. And that is really, really troubling.
In the next episode of Maddie, a criminal profiler lays out her theory about the events of May 3, 2007, in order to answer the biggest question of all, what happened to Madeline McCann?
There's really no good reason for those dogs to hit behind the sofa unless A, they're completely wrong, or B, a body was there. And if there is a body behind the sofa, it's because somebody ended up there.
The Maddie podcast is reported, written, and narrated by me, Mark Salnokonoko. Dan McHugh is our producer and sound designer. Simon King is our editorial advisor and editor. You can read more about this case and the podcast and see interactive graphics and maps on 9.com.au.